Well, you know what? You just about can't go any place anymore without somebody trying to invade your privacy or spying on you or trying to monitor you or putting chips in you. For the next couple hours, we'll be talking with Catherine Albrecht about privacy issues. And she's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Catherine Albrecht, a consumer privacy expert, founder and director of the Casbian Organization, which educates consumers about shopper surveillance. Catherine, also widely recognized as one of the world's leading experts on consumer privacy. She even has her own radio show. And Catherine, that's growing now, isn't it?
Hey, I got to tell you, George, it sure is. Hey, it's good to be on with you tonight. My radio show is now on, gosh, we're up to about 30 radio stations for my daily show. And I do a little 90-second segment that covers privacy topics and other things, and that's on nearly 100 stations around the country. So it's
good for you.
Yeah.
And when you were on with me last week, you sound chipper. You sound like your health is coming back. Are you winning the battle?
You know, I am, and your listeners have just been so wonderful with such an outpouring of support over the last 18 months since I've been dealing with breast cancer, and it's really touched my heart how wonderful people have been to me. I can report the good news. I'm about 6 weeks out from my last treatment, and I am, I guess, now a cancer survivor rather than a cancer patient, and I have about 4.5 inches of hair now.
Oh, it's that red hair is coming back, huh?
It is. And, you know, I didn't know this, but after you've had chemotherapy, your hair actually grows back curly. And
really?
It's a new look for me. You know, I've always had rail straight hair. I've always been one of those girls who had to put it up in curlers if I wanted any body at all. And it came back in kind of like, I'll give it a good spin. It came in kind of like Marilyn Monroe hair, except
perfect.
Red.
Yeah. Perfect. And you know what? I'm not recommending in terms of treatments, but turmeric.
Hey, I'm such a believer in the turmeric. You know, the research on it is fantastic. They're doing research out of MD Anderson.
It gets better and better and better, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, it's not just the cancer that the turmeric works on, but because it's such a powerful anti-inflammatory, it works on all sorts of other diseases. And, in fact, what science is now discovering is that the whole issue of degenerative illness, it's all coming from inflammation in the body. So if you can calm that inflammation down, and, you know, we bring it on ourselves because we eat the wrong foods and we have too much stress and we're surrounded by pollution and noise and chaos. But it seems like turmeric, along with some of those other Indian spices that, you know, hey, God put them all here.
That's
and when
right.
you take them, they kind of soothe the system. So yeah, I'm a big believer. I take turmeric every single day along with about 18. I literally have a cocktail of about 15, 18 different natural supplements that
Super.
I take. And I, to be honest, even though it sounds kind of crazy, I've never felt better.
Good for you. And you've gone on this treatment. You went holistic and conventional, right?
You know, I did, George, and that is that's going to be my next big campaign, I think. You know, I'm still doing the privacy work, and we've got huge news tonight for your listeners, so I'm going to keep everybody up to speed on that. But my experience with a doctorate from Harvard, what they trained me how to do is research. And, you know, back in 1999, 2003, you know, I ran across big bad guys in the form of RFID, you know, the industry
sure.
and what they were planning on doing with these microchips and tracking. And I dealt with that the way I've always dealt with trouble. I researched everything I could find and rolled up my sleeves and fought back. I mean, we had 30,000 different references that Liz McIntyre, my co-author, and I reviewed to write the book Spy Chip. So I'm a researcher, and I'm not afraid of reading original documents. So when I got cancer, I did the same thing. And, you know, my husband, between the two of us, we have 4 Harvard degrees. So he's a researcher, too. And he ran the risk of losing his wife. So he also, even in the roughest parts of my treatment, when I was just not even well enough to do the research, he was up till the wee hours of the night, you know, 2, 3 in the morning, online in PubMed and other research corners of the internet looking this stuff up. And what we discovered was, in my case, and I actually blogged about this, if people want to check it out on my website, I blogged why I did chemo. You know, I
beautiful, good.
From so many people, why would you cut, you know, let them cut, burn, and poison you, Catherine? Are you crazy? And I posted, if people want to go to my website, which I think is linked from yours,
sure is.
KMAshow.com is probably easier than trying to spell out KatherineAlbrecht.com. But if you go there on the blog, I think it's the second entry there. And I actually posted, George, you can go online and you can get the statistics for your particular cancer based on which treatment you do, what your outcome would look like. And so in my case, having had the surgery, which I did have to have a full mastectomy and the lymph nodes removed.
In what stage were you at?
I was stage 3C. So I was as close to stage 4, which is the stage at which point it's become terminal.
That's bad. And 5, that's it for you, right?
Yeah. So, well, you know, there are women who are living much, much longer with stage 4 cancer than they used to. But conventional medicine, by the time you hit stage 4, will often say, you know, we can prolong your life, but it probably will be cancer that will ultimately take your life. So in my case, I was stage 3C, which is, you know, it goes stages 0, 1, 2, and 3, and A, mm-hmm. B, and C. You don't get any closer to 4 than stage 3C.
That's right.
So, and the tumor was enormous. It was nearly 6 centimeters, which is a couple of inches. I mean, not a tiny speck, but a huge lump. And by the time, you know, we had discovered it, it had progressed pretty extensively into my lymphatic system. So what you can do is you can go online, and there are places you can do this. One of them is called LifeMath. Another one is called Adjuvant Online, but regular people don't have access to Adjuvant Online, but doctors do. And they take the statistics of hundreds of thousands of women who have had breast cancer and punch in. You can actually pull down little menus and say, well, I received this treatment and this amount of radiation, and I'm taking tamoxifen. And you put in all your statistics, your age and comorbidities, which, you know, are you diabetic or other things. And then it actually gives you your chances, or the chances of 100 women in your circumstance to live 5 or 15 years. And when I punched in my numbers, they were horrible. I mean, they were really, really terrible. And then when I put in the treatment, the chemotherapy, the radiation, things that are actually known to be effective on stage 3 cancer, the numbers became actually pretty great. And so when people say, why would you allow them to do this, that, and the other, I said, well, because I researched it. And not only did we punch it into all of these databases, but my oncologist wrote an entire chapter on the value of chemotherapy for various kinds of breast cancer. And we sat down with this 40-page thick printout. She printed it out right in her office. She's like, you want to read it? Okay, if you want it, here you go. And we took it home and we highlighted it. My husband went through it with the highlighter and I did too. And on top of that, I got every possible book that one could get on everything from, you know, Gerson therapy to Gerd Hamer to you name it. And I read all of that stuff too. Discarded the stuff that didn't have good backing or good science behind it and embraced the things that did, like turmeric being a perfect example, like mushroom supplements to help you get
right.
chemo, like all the stuff that, you know, that, and I have to tell you one more thing because this was an amazing experience for me. Hawthorn. Have you heard about Hawthorn?
I take Hawthorn supplements. It's good for your heart, but what do you take it for?
That's what I take it for. And not only is it good for your heart, it's amazing because the chemotherapy that I did, adriamycin, is known to be potentially cardiotoxic, meaning that it can reduce your heart function. The same also with Herceptin, which is the other life-saving drug that I was on. So when you have to take these drugs, you really grit your teeth. You know, cancer medicine is not like any other medicine you ever take. Most medicines you take, they just make you better, and that's the end of it. But cancer medicine has to go in and literally kill cells. That's what you want it to do because you've got cells that are trying to kill you. So you expect to have side effects from this, unfortunately, and then you try to mitigate them as best you can. Well, one of the things they had to do with me, because I'm on an experimental drug called TDM1, part of the Herceptin family, for anybody who cares, that drug, they wanted to see if it was damaging my heart. So they did a baseline, what's called an ejection fraction, where they take
That's
a look
right.
at how effectively your heart is ejecting blood with
yeah.
each pump.
It's an echo test.
It's actually called a MUGA, but yeah, it's the same basic kind of a test. It's like an echocardiogram, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking at how when your heart beats, it the more efficient your heart is, the more blood ejects with each beat. And my ejection fraction was expected to drop, you know, a little bit, a fair bit, through the course of these drugs. I took Hawthorn throughout, and get this, George, My ejection fraction improved 20% from the beginning before I did chemo to the end of my chemo.
Well, that's phenomenal.
And it's Hawthorne.
Well, you know, and I always thought that your number had to be for perfect. A perfect echo was 100. It's 80. So they look at 80. So if your numbers are, you know, close to 80, a little higher, you're doing okay.
Yeah, they actually consider anything above 50, believe it or not, to be
is good. Yeah.
So you don't, I guess if you had 100% heart ejection, you'd be Superman or something.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The trainer of the great horse Seabiscuit fed him Hawthorne.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
What a great story.
And the horse kept winning. You know,
And then I looked up Hawthorne because I'm thinking, oh my gosh, is this like digitalis? Am I taking some really potent heart drug that I have to be careful with? And what I discovered is that Hawthorne actually has thousands of years of history. It's eaten as a food in many parts of the country. People eat the greens in salads, and they eat the fruit, and they eat the flowers. It's considered food.
That's right.
So it's really just an amazing thing to learn. Just how God provided all this stuff for us. And I really do believe that there's a mix because, as I mentioned on an earlier show, I guess back in February when I was on the show, I tried for a full month when I first discovered that I had cancer. I said, I don't want to go do chemotherapy and radiation if I don't have to. Let me just clean up my diet and do hypnosis and meditate and pray and do nothing but pure juices and alkalize my body and, you know, fill in all the blanks. And believe me, when you find out you have cancer, you're really motivated. So I spent a month, I did poultices on my breast, I did every possible thing you could think of and took a million supplements and ate right. And,
mm-hmm. and you did everything and then, right.
Well, I went in after a month and I said, listen, I want a sonogram. I want you to repeat this and see if it shrunk. And they all rolled their eyes and said, well, it won't have. And I said, well, check it anyway because I don't want surgery. And they went in and after all that effort, they took a look and they said, it's either the same or if anything, it's grown a little.
Frustrating.
And it was at that point I said, you know what, this thing is big enough that it could kill me. And in fact, by the time they removed it, George, it was so extensive in my lymphatic system under my arm that they couldn't even identify the lymph nodes they removed as lymph nodes. They were just cancer. Mm. There was no lymphatic tissue even left. So had I waited even a couple of months, those lymph nodes were poised to launch off into the rest of my body and send me off into stage four, and then we'd be having a very different conversation right
well,
now.
Well, we sure would. And you so get a little bit of everything with you, Catherine, on the show. Medical advice, privacy issues, people tuning in going, wow, I get it all. So that's
I
good.
Know,
I'm,
I gotta
I'm
say,
glad
well,
you're
I,
doing well.
I, that's the cool thing about researching everything that life throws at you. You've always got something cool to learn.
Sure do. When we take calls later, I want people also not only to ask you questions, but maybe give us some specific stories where they think their privacy has been violated. When I went from St. Louis to Minneapolis today at the St. Louis International Airport, I had to go through a full body scanner. So I did that. And then they stop you coming out and they're on a radio talking to somebody else and they don't let you go until somebody squawks through on their radio, okay, he's fine. What are they doing? Do you know?
You know, I don't because I don't go into the body scanners. I made a decision back before they even introduced those things when I was still just reading about them that I was not going to be nakedized by my government to fly. And so for me, and I travel quite a bit because I give a lot of speeches and speak at international conferences, so I do a lot of travel, but I always insist on the pat-down, and part of the reason I do it is because I don't want to be nakedized, but part of it also is because if all of us did it, you know, you have to be the change you want to see, and I'm always mm-hmm. thinking if every single person in this country said, no, thank you, I won't stand in there and assume the position and put my arms up and be rendered naked by this machine, you're going to have to actually have an employee come over, go to all the bother of taking several minutes to pat me down, that it would so clog up their system that they would have to get rid of those things. So that's my policy. I just say, nope, gotta, you know, take the time, do the pat down. And yeah, it's unpleasant.
Well, do they listen to you and do the pat down or do they send you someplace else?
They always do the pat-down. I've never had any trouble with it. Some people would say the pat-down itself is invasive enough that they don't
do
it. But given the choice between having the back of a TSA agent's hand, you know, go over my body or going through the machine, I think I'll take the agent's hand, frankly, because there's no permanent record of it. There's no visual image of my naked body going into a computer somewhere. But I will tell you something funny. At my,
you led up on TMZ one night.
The last time I flew, I was going through Miami with my husband to go on a vacation to celebrate being done with cancer treatment. We were heading out to the Caribbean.
What a great time to celebrate, too.
It was wonderful. It was it was absolutely wonderful. The water was 85 degrees and crystal clear, so beautiful. But in the Miami airport, it was a pretty unpleasant experience because coming back, we had to go through the scanner. And the woman, as I said, no, I insist on having a pat-down. She came over and she said, you know, do you have any medical implants or anything I should know about? I'll tell you this story because I'm about to go in for reconstruction surgery. I lost a breast through this whole process. But as I stood there and she said this, I was already pretty annoyed. You know, I don't enjoy going through that and being treated like a criminal by my own government.
Yeah.
So I reached in and I have a little puff that I that I wear in my bra. And I pulled it out and
you
I handed
it
to her.
Oh, what'd she do? She freak?
I said, here, we'll have this. I wish I had a video of the look on her face because
she didn't know what to do.
10 million hits on YouTube if I could put her face up there and did it.
She didn't know what to do. Unbelievable. Okay.
No, you can have that back.
With her gloves on, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. She took several steps backwards. But, you know, that's really what it's about, George, is they're really getting intimate with us. And I just wanted to make it very clear, yes, this is extremely intimate, what you were trying to do. You know, does this count? Yep. You want to take a look at this, too?
They sure are. And, you know, and some of them take their jobs a little too seriously, don't they?
Yeah. You know, the kind of person to whom that sort of job appeals, you know, I that sort of raises interesting questions, because would you really want a job where all day long you boss people around and look at them naked and, you know, tell them where to stand and what to do? I mean, I would hate that job.
You know what? We've got to interview a TSA person or several of them on the program. I wonder what their personalities are like in real life, you know, when they're not TSA agents, when they're not, you know, patting people down and doing all this.
Most of them are just, you know, relatively decent, nice people just trying to make a living.
Oh, probably.
But, you know, like everything else, George, power corrupts. And I have had some TSA people be absolutely horrible to me. One woman, I forgot to take my shoes off. This was, I don't know, probably 2 years ago before they even had the nakedizers, maybe three.
Mm-hmm.
And when I realized it, rather than let me just take my shoes off and put them on the conveyor belt and go back through, she pulled me to the side and put me through all kind of misery. You know, and I said I could just take them off and put them on the thing. You know, but there's kind of this attitude that gets into people when they have that sort of power. And, you know, we see it with police brutality. We see it with in all sorts of different
circumstances. Oh, it's everything. It, you know, it's the show of bullies. And,
I kind of liken those people to the high school cafeteria lunch person.
Yeah.
I had a student. I used to tutor students, and I've done a lot of educational consulting. And I had one student who had to eat lunch for a week with the principal at the local middle school here, because during his lunch, he was laughing, and the woman who maintains order in the lunchroom came over with her hairnet on and a whistle in her mouth that she used to maintain order. She walked within a foot of him and whistled in his face instead of just saying, excuse me, can you take it down? He said it was so hilarious.
And then she sent him to the gulag, right?
He said he laughed so hard that the whistle itself just made the laughter so much worse. And she said, all right, that's it, young man.
That's funny. Well, Catherine, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we will talk about privacy issues. First up, let's talk a little bit about Google. What's going on there? RFID chips a little bit later on, and much more, including your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM with our special guest tonight, Catherine Albrecht, as we talk about privacy issues, and we'll let her give us an overview when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Catherine Albrecht. Catherine, what's new in the world of privacy issues? What's up there?
I gotta tell you, there are so many things going on that it's kind of hard to even know where to begin. I've kind of, over the last 10 years, broken it down into two different areas. One of them is digital privacy, the actual bits and bytes that make up the information that's being kept on us. And then the other one is physical privacy, which is your personal body and belongings moving around through space being tracked. And they've kind of begun to split out just a little bit. I think they're going to converge as we go forward. But it makes sense to discuss sort of the bits and bytes, I think, first, and then maybe move into some of the more physical RFID tracking next. So if you look at who has the bits and the bytes, the information on us, the answer to that, hands down, is Google.
By far, right?
I'm sorry?
By far.
Absolutely by far. And when I say by far, like mind-blowingly so, because what Google has managed to do is create an entire multi-billion dollar empire on the basis of offering to the public free services that serve as bait, as it were, to get you and millions and hundreds of millions of other people to say, wonderful, Google, thank you for the free gift of a search engine, of email, of mapping programs, of book availability, of a place to post my photographs, et cetera, et cetera. And while you're thanking Google and using the free service, they're really using the free service as a way to get your personal information. And I think people need to kind of make that shift in their minds and understand that really nothing is for free. That's kind of the first thing I would say. When was the last time a multi-billion dollar corporation gave you all of its products for free? And the answer is they don't. They can't. That's not how, you know, that's not how the free market works. There has to be a trade.
That's not how they stay multi-billion.
That's right. That's right. So what they do is they hire the best and the brightest, and they develop extraordinary technologies. I will be the first person to say that there is nobody who does it better than Google, whatever the it is. They're extraordinarily good at what they do. They make amazingly powerful products that work really well that people love. The problem is that the whole mechanism of how they put everything together is designed to bring you in kind of like a roach motel. Like, I'm sure if I were a roach motel would be the best possible looking place I could ever go. Problem is once I check in, I can't check back out again. So one way to think of it, let's just take a look at Gmail, which is, I think, the easiest example to understand. When people sign up for a Gmail account, they're getting about a $5 monthly value. And they say, well, cool, you know, I have all this free email. I can log on. I can access it anywhere. It's wonderful and it's free. But if you read the fine print of the Gmail account, what you will discover is that Google gives itself the right to read all of the email that you send and receive. And not only that, but to use the email and the person to whom you're writing, the people to whom you're writing, to determine your relationship with each of them and make all of these very detailed entries into not only your database or dossier of information that they keep, but also those are the people you write to. And I'll give you an example. My doctor, my primary care doctor, wanted to get copies of all of my cancer records. And I have those available in a PDF. They're through, you know, my cancer center. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you know, I said, what's the best way to get them to you? She said, just send them to me as an email attachment. And then she writes down her email address on a prescription pad and hands it to me, and it's a Gmail account. Had I sent her, you know, we had a little privacy conversation at that point.
They all would have had it, right?
Yeah. See, here's what people don't understand. Had I actually sent the PDF, which, you know, it's like a 40-page document of paperwork and blood test results and the names of my doctors and the medications I've been on and everything, had I sent that to her as a PDF attachment, Google, according to their terms of service, because it would have been part of her account at that point, has given themselves the legal right and the contractual right, according to that contract, to take that PDF and scan it and get all the information out of it and put it in my record and in her record. So when you understand that, and I want to get back to this roach motel, it's kind of like if somebody said, let's say a really wonderful hotel with beautiful 4-star rooms said, we'll give you a room for free. You know, why pay rent? Why bother paying rent if you could just come and stay here for free?
Sure.
There's only one little catch. The entire place is bugged. We've got cameras in the showers, cameras in the toilets. We've got sensors on the beds. We're going to be watching you. You know, microphones, the phones are bugged. But it's okay because we're giving you a free hotel room. Most people would say, ew, that's too creepy for me. I'd rather go get a job and actually pay rent. Thank you. So it's kind of the same with the email. It's the same with the search engine. It's the same with all the other Google services. Is they're saying, here's this really wonderful thing. You know, we've got like 400 thread count sheets in our beautiful hotel and room service, and everything's perfect, except for one little catch. Once we get you in, we're going to watch you.
And
that's
you don't
the whole
get
reason
out.
Why we built the hotel.
That's right.
So we could attract you in so we could record what you do.
Now, let me ask you this. When they started something like Google, when the three guys did it, right?
Sergey Brin, yeah.
Two guys.
Yeah.
Well, when they started it, were they thinking that long term?
I don't think so, because I think like so many other things, it really has grown with them. You know, I was recently reading, Apple's kind of my other bugaboo. Apple and Google are my two companies that are giving me the cold chills lately. And, you know, Steve Jobs wrote something very interesting. He said, you know, it's rare that you have the opportunity to actually make the future. You know, normally we are inheriting the present from other people. You know, our language, our food, our customs, our clothing, everything comes from people who came before us. He said, but Apple is doing something very unique, and that's building the future ourselves with our own hands from scratch right now, and we don't know what it will become. And I really think that Sergey and Larry, when they created Google, had that same sense. Now Google has become this enormous force that even I, and George, I spend all my time working on these kinds of issues, even I don't think I have even a glimmer of the enormity of what Google has become today. Because I don't think you can. Understand it. You know, they were asked at one point, what do you envision Google becoming at some, you know, in the future? And the answer was, like the mind of God. You know, think about that for a minute. What a thing to say. Like the mind
of God. That is frightening.
How
many people actually, when they go onto Google every day, actually think about all that?
Well, they don't, because it's what I refer to as the default settings. You know, when you get a new computer, it comes with all the defaults, and probably the easiest one for people to understand is Microsoft Word. You know, you get Times New Roman 12-point font. That's what you get. You get a white background with black type in Times New Roman 12-point font. You can go in and you can change the default settings. You can write in Arial instead of Times New Roman. You can write in 15-point font instead of 12-point font. But there are these default settings that most of us don't think to change. You know, it's the same with life, right? You go K through 12 public school. You may or may not go to college. You get a job. You work till you retire. And that's the default setting of life. So most of us accept those default settings and don't really think about them much. When it comes to computing, the default setting is that you have either a Windows, you know, nowadays Windows 7 operating system that's running, you know, Windows Explorer, Microsoft Explorer, and Internet Explorer, and that's your default setting. You know, or if you load in Firefox or Safari, then you're going to be loading that default setting. And for so many businesses and schools and home computers, when you first fire up your web browser, there's Google. I mean, it's just right there. It's the default setting.
It pops up.
And because it's helpful and it gives you answers, it feels kind of like the big answer guy in the sky.
Yeah.
I have a question. I'll just log on and ask Google the answer. And people don't think that through. You know, because it's been given to them.
What about people, though, Catherine, who simply say, yeah, I don't care about, you know, so they have information on this or my medical records. Big deal. Should they be concerned, and why?
You know, it's interesting. In an interview not too long ago, Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO of Google, he was actually asked, you know, so people are treating Google like their most trusted friend. Should they be? And he had a very interesting response. He said, if you know, we are watching what you do. And if you don't want us watching what you do, maybe you shouldn't be doing it. And I found that so extraordinarily offensive, because what he was really saying is, I mean, I'll take my own self as an example. If I want to research cancer because I felt a lump and I'm terrified, should I not be doing that because I don't want Eric Schmidt to know it?
Right.
Or if
right.
a woman has suffered a miscarriage and is looking for some support, should she not be doing that if she doesn't want the whole world to know it?
Well, and then when you do that, Catherine, all of a sudden on every page you search, up comes all kinds of things about cancer, whether it's medicine or treatments or alternative health, but they know who what you're looking for and they target you.
Right. And see, this is where the people who want to invade your privacy make a lot of money from doing it. And Google has this kind of sly, sort of sneaky sleight of hand for how they do it, because they will say truthfully, we don't sell your information to third parties. That's not how we operate. And that's true. Google's model is not selling your personal information to anybody else, but it is taking money from others so that the personal information that they've managed to accumulate on you becomes valuable because they can target you with the ads. Now, Google runs the ads. Google identifies who the cancer patients are, the women who've had miscarriages, or the people who've lost their homes. Google identifies them, and then Google serves the ads. And so you might say, well, where's the real harm? Because the only entity that has this information is Google. They're not sharing it with others. And the reality is that Google is very much has the potential to share this with others, and they're the others that you probably least want it shared with, and that is governments and international law enforcement, and on at least one previous high-profile occasion, hackers who've gotten into Google systems. So it's the same thing I've said about supermarket cards and RFID data and everything else. If you don't want the information to fall into the wrong hands, even if you trust Google, that Google has your best interest at heart and they're a wonderful company and they'd never do anything to harm you, simply by amassing that amount of personal information about you, they're putting you at risk of people who could abuse it, because they're low-hanging fruit, and Google is the go-to place right now for information about the public. They know more than the CIA, the IRS, the FBI, and the NSA combined. They know more about you and about me, George, simply from the times that we've even accidentally landed on Google's website, than probably, you know, our most trusted friends. And that's their business. That's what they do. And they've got brilliant people who spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to do it better.
You helped start StartPage, which was a search engine which would get around some of this. How's it going? What's happening with it?
Yeah, I would like to challenge everybody out there to stop saying Google it and start saying StartPage it, because isn't it funny? I'm a radio host, as are you, George, and I think every day about how many millions of dollars of free business Google gets when radio hosts say, oh, yeah, just go Google that. And so I'm trying to start a new movement. Just go start page that.
Now, did you change the name? It was not always start page,
well,
was it?
Well, there's actually two search engines. And for people who aren't familiar, start page and IxQuick, IxQuick.
That's a tough one.
I know. It's hard to spell and hard to remember. Yeah. So start page is a lot easier. Start
sure
protecting
is.
Your privacy with your start page and make it your home page. So it is your start page or your launching page. But what they are is private search engines that answer your questions the same way Google does, but without being the hotel with the cameras in the walls and the recording devices in the phones. That it's like checking into a hotel that is completely private and locked down and all the shades are drawn and it's soundproofed. It's kind of like that. So when you log on to StartPage and submit a search there, what StartPage does, what we do at StartPage, is take your search and we submit it from our server to Google, get the actual Google results, and then return them back to you in complete privacy with no tracking cookies. We don't record your IP address. We make no record that you were even on the website. We don't record what you searched for. It's all overwritten. It's not even overwritten with zeros. It's never recorded in the first place. So if someone were to hack into or subpoena our database, there would be nothing in there but zeros. What was searched for?
Good.
000. Who searched it? 000. There's nothing there.
Speaking of hacking, my personal email got hacked several weeks ago.
Ow.
From people in Hungary. We were able to find that out. And what they did was they then, in my contact list, sent my email to everybody on my contact sheet trying to get them to buy fat supplement pills. And all my executives at the network got it, my bosses, friends, people, they all got these fat supplement pills from me. Half of the people, because they know me, they trust me, said, hey, we might try this. What do you think? So they opened it up. Unbelievable.
Oh, no. And you know, George, the other part that's dangerous about that is if they can pretend to be someone trusted, you know, like if you sent me an email, I would certainly open it.
You're going to open it. That's right.
There's another nasty thing that they can do, which is put malware into the email itself. So that it says, hey, this is George. Hey, Catherine, you're going to be on the show coming up. I need you to click up this document and answer, you know, fill out this web form, whatever. I don't know. And then I click the thing, and voila, the thing is malicious code. That's
and they've got you.
Infiltrate my computer.
Yeah.
So the key to that, there's a couple of keys. I without going into too much detail, are you using a web login email?
Yeah, so I ended up changing my password. That seems to have solved that problem, but I have no idea how they got my the username and the original password.
Two ways they could have done it, and this is probably good privacy advice for everybody out there. When you log on to any web-based email, so whether it's Gmail, Yahoo, Hotmail, whatever, if it's web-based email, and a lot of the smaller emails are also webmail, if you're doing that from a coffee shop or a Wi-Fi, or even if you're doing it from your own home and you're not secured properly, a Wi-Fi sniffer can actually catch that information out of the air and use it, you know, record it, and then use it later to log in and do stuff to your account.
Wow.
So one way to protect yourself against that is use the SSL encrypted version of the pages. And without getting too technical, that means, you know where you see HTTP, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah, www, such, such, such?
Yeah.
Try putting an S in there, HTTP, S as in Sam or as in security. And when you do that, actually StartPage was the first search engine to offer that as the default. When you go to startpage.com, it punches the S in there. And what that means is that the page and everything you type into it is encrypted. So that even if somebody were to sniff it, they would just get gobbledygook that they couldn't read. The only people who can read it are you and the website you're visiting.
So you do HTTPS. Now, I just go on and do www dot and off I go.
Yeah, and if you do that, first of all, if you have a link that you're clicking from, you can make the link be HTTPS, like if it's a bookmark or something that you've put in there. But if you look up and you see HTTP, you can manually go up there and click in that little address bar, and you can try putting the S in if you're in a place that you don't feel comfortable. Maybe you're at a train station or an airport or, you know, a coffee shop, and you're thinking, this is a little shady. I'm not real comfortable with the internet connection that I'm on. Potentially even in hotels, there was a recent hacking scandal where people were using the hotel Wi-Fi to get people's personal information. But if you've got that S on there, then nobody can intercept it. And in fact, even your ISP, your internet service provider, your Comcast or Verizon or Quest or whoever's providing your service, even they can't see what you're doing, which is really cool because we know that...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Verizon, one of the bad things that happened under the Bush administration is that Verizon, or was it AT&T? Well, it was in California. They set up, the NSA set up a listening post, I want to say AT&T, in the actual place where all the data was moving back and forth illegally. And they scanned everybody's phone calls and emails and passwords and everything else. That was the U.S. government doing that. Had all of that information been HTTPS encrypted, then they could have scanned it all they wanted, but they couldn't have read it. So that's why StartPage and EFF is doing the same thing, the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
A number of other websites are automatically using that encrypted standard. So anytime you go to startpage.com or ixquick.com, you will automatically see that everything you do there is encrypted.
Super. Catherine, we're going to come back top of the hour. We'll talk about what are they trying to do to chip people. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.